Today, I would like to review a little bit on the political history and then the religious history of this country of Namibia. I'll begin by just pointing out to you on the map, lots of people don't know where Namibia is. This is it here, way down here in Southwest Africa. Now, you look at this map, all the countries of Africa are mentioned here, and they all have different names from what we may have learned, or at least what I learned when I was in school many years ago, because almost all of these countries now are independent countries, with the exception of Namibia. Namibia is not independent. Namibia is still an occupied, colonialized country. But all these other countries now have their African names. Namibia down here was first discovered, well, I don't know, discovered. The first people who landed there were Portuguese seamen. Remember, during the days of, right after the Renaissance, the voyages of discovery, and then the age of colonialization, all the European countries were scrambling around Africa to get colonies. And Germany was a little bit late in this colony business. So it wasn't until around in the 1880s that they got a hold of Namibia and what is over here, Tanzania, was by a different name then. Up to that time, the European peoples, the leaders of the European countries, they would meet up there in Europe with a map of Africa, and with the pencil they would draw lines all over the place, and that's the way they made these countries. They didn't pay attention to the traditional tribal lands and so forth. So, for example, Namibia, here in the northern part, the tribe that lives there is the Ovambo tribe. It's the largest tribe in Namibia, several hundred thousand people. But part of the Ovambos are also living in Angola. And so the Ovambos are quite accustomed to moving back and forth between Angola and Namibia. They didn't have that border. That's a difficulty now, of course. The South African troops keep making incursions into that border, across that border into another sovereign country, in order to, as they say, in order to get after the Namibian guerrillas and to shoot up the refugee camps. Well, that's going a little ahead of my story. Namibia then became a German colony. It was called German Southwest Africa. And this was in the 1881 or so, in the 1880s. Germany, however, lost its colonies, as some of you probably will recall, through the Treaty of Versailles after the First World War. And at that time, the League of Nations turned Namibia over to South Africa, mandated to South Africa, with the mandate to nurture this country to independence. This is what South Africa was supposed to do. And I have to tell you that South Africa has never done anything like this whatsoever. They have treated Namibia ever since as though it were one of their own provinces. There are four provinces in South Africa. Namibia is like their fifth province. At that time, South Africa was a part of the British Empire, as you will recall. I can remember this from my own school days. When you look at a world map, about one-fourth of it was colored pink. That was the color for the British Empire, you know. South Africa gained its independence. There were the Boer Wars and so forth. And anyway, to make a longer story short, South Africa became an independent federation of four republics, the four provinces, and it's the Union of South Africa, as they called it then. And they continued to hang on to Namibia. In 1948, in South Africa is when they really set up by law all kinds of apartheid laws, the separation laws put the black people in the lowest stratum of society. And they also used those same kind of laws, although it isn't the law in Namibia now, but it is the practice, the same kind of apartheid in Namibia. And South Africa continues to hang on to Namibia for a number of reasons. Number one, of course, economic. Namibia, while it is 80% desert, has rich mineral wealth. They have diamonds and copper and tin and uranium and lithium and some other exotic kind of minerals that I don't even know what they are, but they're important for various things. And South Africa is exploiting it for all it's worth. I have to tell you also, not only South Africa is profiting, but also Britain and France and the United States. And the wealth that they are taking out of Namibia, they're not pouring it back in. There's a rumor about that South Africa has taken as many diamonds out of Namibia as they can right now because they see the handwriting on the wall, it's going to be independent, and by the time it's independent, they figure to have all the diamonds out of there and leave Namibia impoverished, which is very likely to happen. This is the kind of thing that did happen in some of the other African countries. They were left impoverished. The colonial powers kind of exploited them. Namibia seems like it's going to be worse than any of the others. So for economic reasons, they want to hold on to it. For political reasons also, they will say, because Namibia is the last country of Africa not to be independent. And South Africa, you see, is bordered by these independent black countries. They would like to have at least one buffer state between them and, this so-called frontline state, Angola, which has a Marxist government. The South Africans are deathly afraid of any kind of what is called a Marxist government. Mozambique also has a Marxist government. Zimbabwe is slightly, they call that Marxist too. Botswana is not. But these are the so-called frontline states. And they like the South Africans like to have a buffer somewhere along the line. I should say something about that just for now. A lot of times people worry about these countries being communist. This is not true. Even to say that they have a Marxist government is not the same as saying these are communist countries along the order of, Russia or the so-called Iron Curtain countries. It is not true. These countries have a form of African socialism, we would have to say, which they are not ruled in any way by Russia. Although, for example, the Namibia guerrillas have received help from the so-called Iron Curtain countries because they asked the Western countries first and were turned down. And as they have said, when a person is thirsty, he will take a drink of water from whoever will give him a drink. And so this is what they were obliged to do. So at this moment, then, Namibia is illegally occupied by about 100,000 South African troops, a small population of 1.5 million. You can figure out the ratio there. It's highly militarized. Everywhere you go, you see soldiers and military vehicles. Caspers, these are big military troop carriers, Caspers. They run along the roads. They like to
they like to run over cars, and believe me, they do that from time to time. And they say, whoops, I didn't see that one. And people get killed. I can't tell you how many times one of our students would go back north, let us say, for a funeral of a relative or friend that had died in an auto accident. I can't believe how many so-called auto accidents.
There weren't very many autos.
There weren't that many autos. You could drive 50 miles and never see another car. Well, there were more in the north, I suppose. The population is a few more population in the north. No, it's mostly cows and steers running across the roads up there. So this, the United Nations, by the United Nations Security Council Resolution 435, has declared that South Africa must cease and desist in its occupation of Namibia, and a decision. This was, I think, about 1966, and after that, also a decision came out of the World Court in The Hague to the same effect, and South Africa has paid absolutely no attention whatsoever to these rules that have been handed down by international law. So that's the presently the situation in Namibia politically. That's a little bit of the political history.
I just want to say that Namibia is an African name. They have, and a lot of people do not accept that name. They insist on calling it Southwest Africa, people that live in Namibia. I remember once at a library, they were having some special thing, and it had Namibia, and somebody would come cross it out and write West, Southwest Africa, and then somebody else would come cross it out and put Namibia back. And so it was a little battle of what the name of that country was.
Yeah, well, those were the white folks who were doing that, you have to remember. And in fact, the black people don't call South Africa South Africa, they call it Azania. Azania, Azania. That's the African name for South Africa. And when it ever becomes independent, that's undoubtedly the name that they will give it. Now, I mentioned to you about the population. By the way, anytime anybody wants to interrupt, I want you to feel free to do that, you know, just ask or make a comment. Yes, please.
I have a question. What's the size of the country in relation to any one of our states?
A good question there. Namibia is a pretty large piece of land. It is as large as California, Washington, and Oregon together in the territory, yes. Pretty large. And think of it, only 1.5 million people in that huge area. Well, the country is said to be about 80% desert. So that's one of the reasons for the small population. But as I said, it does have wealth. It has mineral wealth. The northern part of the country, which is Ovango land and Kavango land up here, that's where there most of the farming, extensive farming, can be done there. There's a river here. There's the Kunene River here, and over here the Okavango River, which runs this way, by the way, and ends in a swamp. These are the only flowing rivers, and here the Orange River down here, which is the southern boundary. Those are the only rivers with water in the whole country. All the riverbeds here are dry riverbeds. And seasonal. Once, if you have a really good rain, you might have a flow in there. And some of you who saw our pictures saw that after 7 years of drought, in the eighth year finally there was a good rain, heavy rain, in the Swakop River, upon which, where the seminary was located that we worked at, was filled as a rushing, roaring stream for the first time in years and years. But see, it's a desert country. And the dirt roads, most of the roads are dirt. There's a few paved roads that the South Africans have built in order to move their military people around. But most of the roads we would be driving on very often are dirt, and they just go down through into the riverbeds like that, and there's no bridges. So when they're filled with water, you're just kind of stuck unless you want to wade across, and that could be dangerous.
Fun,
and fun, yeah. Oh. This is kind of interesting. One of you had asked me about this before. Namibia has this narrow piece of land going through here, which is called the Caprivi Strip. It's named after Baron Caprivi, who was, I think, the prime minister or chancellor, whatever you call him, of Germany after Bismarck in the previous century. Named after him. And this piece of territory was ceded by the British to the Germans because the Germans wanted to have access to the Zambezi River, which comes right by here. By the way, right here where these four countries come together, Namibia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe, and Botswana, is where you find Victoria Falls, which is on the Zambezi River, which is one of the most spectacular natural sites that we have, I think both of us agree, we have never seen anything so spectacular as the Victoria Falls. So if you ever have a chance, you must go and visit there. But visit Namibia for other reasons if you can. Let's see, what else can we say? Oh yeah, in the northern part also, just a little south of Lovambo land is a large area called the Etosha Pan, and this is an area where there's a game reserve, and the pan is an area that is mostly dry, but then when there's a rainy season, it's covered over as a very shallow lake, and there are fish in it and everything, and we have always wondered where they come from, but they're there, and there's all kinds of animals, and you can go up there and visit the pan certain seasons of the year, and you can see in the wild elephants and zebra and giraffe, and if you're lucky maybe and have binoculars, you can see a lion, a couple of lions, and warthogs and wildebeest and, well, whatever you can think of, ostrich.
And in the rainy season, you can see thousands and thousands of flamingos. In that pan.
Oh yeah, and then you can see they're in other parts of the country too. And then the typical southern African animals, the kudu and the springbok and what else?
Ostrich and the baboon.
The baboon in Namibia, but I mean the buck, the springbok and the kudu, those are typically,
and
the gems buck, yeah, that you can see. Those are antelope type of animals, perhaps some of you knew that. And some of those were around where we were in the central part where the seminary was. We would see kudu and maybe springbok and ostrich around there from time to time. But the other kind of animals had moved all away from there. They once upon a time were also there, but now they're all concentrated in the north in the game reserve. Perhaps you would like to know about some of the, our time is running, still okay. Some of the African tribes to be found in Namibia. You have the Nama, the Damara, and the San. I put them together because I think, I'm not aware of the, I don't know if the anthropologists are positive of this, but that they are possibly related peoples. At least their language are related. The San people, by the way, are what we mostly know as the Bushmen. The Bushmen. The Nama and the Damara speak about the same language, and their language is a click language. It has four clicks in it. And it's only fairly recently become a written language, and so when they write it down, they show the clicks like this. What are the other?
Just a plain dash.
A dash like that, or no, a slash. Yeah. Well, anyhow, that's where they write it down. But they have these clicks in their language, and it's very interesting to hear this. It's a difficult language. You have to click in a certain tone too. Some clicks are different from other clicks.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, one man's name would be Pastor Novib.
Pastor Novib. We don't know how to do the clicks. You know, there's four different kind of clicks. One is in the back of the throat, one is in the front, and one is with the teeth and so forth. Yeah, one of our colleagues was Pastor Engelhardt Novib. She always says I don't do it right. She's probably do it, but I don't think she does either. But what is really interesting is to hear a Nama choir in church sing a song, and you hear all these clicks coming along. You know, the whole choir is clicking together at the right times, and they're singing a German chorale. That's what really sounds strange. It's one of the things we were, in a way, I guess we were disappointed. We couldn't find any really traditional music among the folks of Namibia. They took up what the missionaries taught them, the German chorales, and in the north, a lot of the Finnish religious music. The Finns had missionized in the north.
How much German influence still remains there?
A lot.
German is one of the three official languages. German, English, and Afrikaans are the three official languages, and it is still taught in the schools.
And in most towns of any size, they'll have a private German school. And the teachers mostly come from Germany.
From Germany, yeah.
And the public schools are taught in Afrikaans, but the German schools are mostly all private, and they're some of the bigger schools. And the store, if you go in the shops, most people will talk German to you first. And everything is, most of the stuff is imported from Germany. And well, most of the little towns are German.
Yeah, probably. In Windhoek, that's the capital city, which is about in the geographical center of the country. 80,000 people, it's true. And you know, all the names of the shops, they're Ziegler and Koch and Schmidt. And Kaiserstrasse is the main street. And in Swakopmund, the main street is Kaiser Wilhelmstrasse. And in Windhoek, I don't know if you should say Windhoek or Windhoek, which is like Hawaii or Hawaii, but anyway, in Windhoek, one of the streets is named Göringstrasse. It's named after Hermann Göring's father, who was one of the early governors, apparently, one of the colonial governors in Namibia. I think he wasn't as bad a person as Hermann, but anyway, he's a Göring. Leutweinstrasse, you know, German names for the streets, you know.
So they heard, I remember when we were there, one of the things that they had, an interim government took over, and they were supposed to, you know, really loosen things up and make things better for black people. So one of the things they were going to do was change the names of the streets. And our students weren't too impressed. They figured there were a lot of other things they would like to see changed more than the names of the streets.
That's right. Okay, I mentioned these tribes. And I'd like to say, maybe later if we have time, I'll say more about the Sandy, because those Bushmen are such interesting people. The largest tribe numerically is the Ovambo, and there are various sub-tribes among them. I think the Kavango people are related to the Ovambo.
Seven different.
Yeah, and they have a whole bunch of different languages, but are related languages. They mostly can understand one another. And they are concentrated more in the northern part of the country, where there's better land for agriculture. Oh yeah, the Herero. I wanted to mention them. The Herero. These also are it seems, at least by their language, related peoples to the Ovambos. The Herero ladies are the ones who wear these clothes that Lois was talking about before, these mini skirts and these wide hats. It's actually Victorian, and they learned it from the German missionaries.
The Damara also wear it, but their hat is a little bit different.
Their hat is wider.
And the Damara at one time were, servants, or slaves.
Yeah, they said
Herero.
They were sort of a servant
tribe to the Herero, yeah, that's right.
So they, you know, I guess they follow some of their customs.
And then there's one other group that I have to mention to you, and you'll have to pardon the expression, but this is what they are called. Bastards, and it means almost what you might think it means, because it refers to people of mixed blood, European, African blood. And they call themselves Bastards very proudly. In South Africa, those people are simply called colored. In the South African social system, of course, the whites are on top. And then in South Africa, you have colored and Indians, that is, East Indians, and then the blacks and the various tribal groups. And in Namibia, the colored, they call themselves Bastards. There's one town in Namibia named Rehoboth, which is almost totally populated by these particular people. And maybe some of you have heard me say it, that they probably came up from South Africa, from Cape Town, where the colored are called the Cape Colored. And they say that the colored race began 9 months after the first white people landed, which is probably pretty accurate. As a matter of fact, I have often thought it's an interesting thought to me. P.W. Botha, the state president of South Africa, if somebody wanted to look into his ancestry, they'd probably find some black people in there. I doubt whether any of them, you know, they used to take they had black people as slaves, and the plantation owners would use the women. They would do that. So the Bastards or colored usually have European names. Their surnames will be French or German or Dutch types of names. The others have, of course, African names. Okay, any comments at this point, Pat?
Are any of those nomadic? I mean, Bushmen are nomadic, right?
The Bushmen are. The others, not anymore, though perhaps once the Nama once were, but they're more settled now.
And they use the desert, the San people.
They do. The San people or Bushmen know how to survive in the desert. They're such interesting people to me, just to read about them. And I know you've, probably many of you have seen that video or that film, The Gods Must Be Crazy. And I always admire that little Bushman in there and the way he conducted himself. I can say a few things about the Bushman. I was reading up on them. I don't know this from personal experience, but from reading. Some of the white folks have said traditionally the Bushmen are people you can't tame. They're savages. You don't tame them. They're uncivilized. And you see, of course, that depends on what you call being civilized. In their relationships with one another, in their relationships with nature, and with other people other than their own, in fact, they're extremely civilized, the Bushmen. Very, very humane and respectful in their behavior. They share things with one another. They can survive a drought, because when a drought comes, they will share with people who are suffering more than they. They will share. They are hunters. They are painters. Some of the Bushmen painting you saw, some of you saw the slides. They have done rock paintings. Sculptors, musicians, dancers, storytellers, and as we said, really great knowledge of nature. Well, what does it mean to be civilized? I don't know. I think they're pretty civilized. Mostly we think that civilization has to do with how far along you are in your technology. This is not necessarily so, in my opinion.
I'm sure if they found a white man who was really in trouble in the desert, they would help him.
Absolutely, no question.
If it meant risking their own life, and, you know, if they'd have to share the little water that they have, they would do it.
They would.
You can be sure the white man wouldn't do it for them, which is kind of sad.
They have ways of surviving in the desert. One of the little examples that has always intrigued me is when there's a shortage of water, when there's been a drought and they don't know exactly where the nearest water might be, they will capture baboons and feed them food that will make them thirsty. And then they will set them free and follow them. And the baboons will go to the nearest water.
And another thing that they do, there's a certain bird that knows where the honey is. And the bird will come and chatter at them, and then they call it the honey bird, and then they'll follow this bird, and the bird will lead them right to where the honey is. And they can climb straight up a rock to get that honey.
Yeah. They're short people, but they are not pygmies. We don't. That is not the right word for them. Their average height, I am told, is about 5 feet.
You could always pick them out if they're.
What's another characteristic? They could eat when there was plenty and store food inside in their bodies.
Yeah, in their buttocks.
In the buttocks.
They have like a shell.
And it shells out.
And then during the drought, then they use that all. It's like a camel. Stores, they store the food too, and then they use it during the
kind of an interesting characteristic time. that some of these, that many of them have.
One of the things that at least Americans often think about in terms of Africa is cannibalism. Is that any of that going on?
I don't even know even of any tradition of it in previous centuries. I have never heard of that in Namibia at all. I think not. No.
Do the bastards take up the technological kinds of jobs, like driving and the more modern jobs?
They are on the social and economic scale than the blacks. This is true. They will get some managerial jobs, for example, as long as they're not over white people. The big boss, you know, that's always got to be a white person. But they can be over blacks and often are. In the mines, for example, a foreman perhaps might be a bastard like that. And the ones who do the really tough and dirty work, those are going to be all black people. Yeah.
And the other thing that's interesting about the way South Africa, you know, has all these, you're white, colored, and black. I remember a little girl that went to school with the German couple's girl, and she had to go away to boarding school, and she brought her little friend home from time to time, and this little girl was blonde and blue-eyed, and I figured she was a little German girl, but she was colored. Her mother was colored and her father was German, so she was classified as colored, even though she's blonde and blue-eyed. But when she grows up, if she wants to, she could possibly have her status changed to white. And in the paper, you could read so-and-so classified white, so-and-so classified colored, and so-and-so classified black. You know, I guess every once in a while they just change their classification. I don't know on what basis, but maybe if you look more white than colored or whatever. But if a white marries a colored, then he must move out of the white area into the colored. Marries black. I mean, moving into the colored area isn't so bad, because it's fairly decent. Moving into the black, that's bad.
Yeah. I would like to talk now a little bit about the mission history in Namibia. And as we're talking here, if you want to interrupt at any moment, you're certainly free to do it. The first Christian missionaries to come to Namibia were sent, and this is in the early 1800s, from the London Missionary Society, and then a little later also from the Wesleyan Missionary Society. The London Missionary Society was an interdenominational group, and they even sent some German missionaries. The Wesleyan Society was mostly Methodist in its orientation, but they didn't succeed too well, and it was finally when the Rhenish Missionary Society, the Rhenish Missionary Society of Germany, came in about 1842, and they in fact, by request of the Wesleyans, took over the Wesleyan mission stations too. And then this Rhenish Missionary Society really went to work. So that they are at work there in the central and southern parts of Namibia. So they brought in German missionaries, and one of the earliest mission stations was the little village of Otjimbingwe, which is the village where we lived and where the Paulinum Seminary is located. This was an important way station along the road from Windhoek, the capital city, to Swakopmund on the coast. Otjimbingwe was in a direct line, and so in the days of the late 19th century, the ox cart people trekking to carrying goods to Swakopmund or moving and so forth would stop off at Otjimbingwe to repair their wagons and get supplies and stuff. So Otjimbingwe, for a couple of years, was the capital city of Namibia. And it always was interesting to me to find that when the International Postal Union was formed, the first post office of Namibia was in Otjimbingwe. Now there's no post office there, and it's just 40 miles off the paved road is Otjimbingwe. We had to go 40 miles to get our mail anymore. So Otjimbingwe, the glory, sic transit gloria mundi, you know, that's the way it goes. But it's still an important place. The oldest Christian church building is found in Otjimbingwe, and some of you saw that in the pictures, built in 1862. The German missionary Hugo Hahn, it's a name that's known among the Lutheran Christians of the Rhenish Missionary Church. In fact, the full name, formal name of that church is the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Southwest Africa, parentheses, Rhenish Mission. And I think that's still the official name of the church that they use.
They dropped the Rhenish
Mission. Well, when we were there, they were still using it. I would all see it in parentheses at the end, Rhenish Mission. So that's where the Germans came in and formed, and two churches came out of that, separate Lutheran churches. I'm sorry to tell you what this is, the black and the white. So that now, The Black Lutheran Church numbers about 190,000 members, and the White Lutheran Church about 10,000. It's very small. But the whites said, "Oh, we want to have our own separate little thing," and they get their pastors from Germany. Meanwhile, Finnish missionaries, by request of the Germans, of the Rhenish Missionary Society, came into the northern part here of Ovamboland, and they began to do their work there. The German missionaries were saying, "We can't handle the whole country, so you guys go up there," and Finnish missionaries came there. Now, the northern Ovamboland, where more of the people live, it's a more crowded population there. The Ovambo Church, it's called officially now Evangelical Lutheran Church in Namibia, and they number, let me see, I've forgotten the number, they number about three, do you remember, Lois, the number? 390,000, I think it is. They're larger. They're a larger church, about 390,000 members. So that's a pretty big group of Christian people. And these two Lutheran churches together, I'm assuming that many of you are Lutheran people, and so you'll pardon me if I seem to be emphasizing Lutheranism here,
These two Lutheran churches together, these two black Lutheran churches, established the seminary where we were teaching in Ochimbingwe. And so there are students then from both of the churches that come there to take up their pastoral studies. Yes, sir?
Was the finish completely black, or was that a black and white?
No, it's all black. And yeah. In the north, the only white people in the north are the
military
people and their dependents. Yeah. Yes, please.
You said that the church is black and white. What happens to the color?
Oh, excuse me. The colored are part of the black church. Yes. In the Rhenish Church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Southwest Africa, Elkswa, as we call it in the South, that includes colored congregations.
But
yes.
There in the city of Windhoek, there's one congregation for the colored, one colored congregation for the black.
That's the way it is, yeah.
Although the colored church does have a black pastor now from the north, which is really a big step forward.
It is. The pastor is an Ovambo pastor. And they have accepted him. He's a crackerjack. He's a really good pastor, and he knows what he's doing.
And the Ovambo people are very dark. Yeah.
Quite dark. Colored people would be a little lighter.
Quite a bit lighter.
Yeah, and let's see.
The Nama people are, classified black, are fairly light.
A little
and
lighter.
And the Damas are
quite dark.
Blue black. They're real. So there's different colors.
And the sand are sort of
copper.
Yellowish brown. Yeah. They're golden. Much lighter color. Kind of a nice color. Like a nice suntan, you know.
But, you know, those different shades of color are important to some of those people, even. So it's good when they, you know, the church makes steps to join them together.
How did the seminary work? Did they get along together at the seminary? The whites and whites?
Well, at the seminary, there are no whites. The only white people at the seminary were Lois and me and our German colleague and his family. And then the other lecturers at the seminary are Namibians, some from the north, some from the south. Yeah. They accepted us very well, if that is perhaps your question. They,
no, I thought you said the whites and the blacks had the same.
The blacks and the colors have the same.
Black and colored are together, yes. No, the whites, they get their pastors from Germany, the white Lutheran church. Yeah. There are some good folk in the white Lutheran Church, however, who they kind of cross over and associate with the folks in the black church and are of help and render service to. I have to say that we have to be fair about it.
Yeah, they're trying hard to bring the churches together.
Mm-hmm. I think some of the leaders of the white Lutheran Church would like to come together with the blacks, but their constituency doesn't allow them, and they tend to bow to that a little bit. I suppose it's understandable, but it's a very great disappointment also. Let's see, I want to say some other things about the church, the Finnish folk. They had their first baptism in 1883. So in 1983, they had a big celebration, 100 years of Christianity in Ovambo land from the Finns. And all the Lutheran bishops were there to celebrate with them, and from the United States also the Lutheran bishops were there. Bishop Crumley, Bishop Preuss, and I think Hertzfeld was there, and then some from Finland, of course, Finnish. And they had a big celebration. They had services, the way their services last, you know, 5, 6, 7 hours of worship services and everybody getting his oar in and preaching 20 or 30 minutes and so forth. It's quite a thing that they do.
Maybe why they don't last longer is because by 5 or 5:30 they have to come to an end because people have to start getting back home again because a lot of them live maybe an hour or 2 hours from where the service was, and they have to get off the road before the sun goes down because the curfew, they get shot at. So everything always has to quit around 5.
That's in the northern part. Where we were, that was not the case. But when we travel up north, we also had to observe that curfew. We had to get off the road. We were also watching the sun go down, you know, and stepping, pressing the pedal to the metal, you might say, so that we could get to our destination.
Other religions are over there.
Other religions?
Yeah.
Christian, are you thinking particular?
Or otherwise.
See, the country is estimated to be 85% Christian. So other religions, there are no Muslims there. There are no traditional religions that I know of, African religions that I know of. So I'm thinking that the other 15% may be just no religion. But among the Christians, the Lutheran group is the largest. Then the Catholics, numbering about 180,000. And then the Anglicans, which is what we know as Episcopal here, about 60,000. Those are the three major. Then you also have the African Methodist Episcopal Church, which was started by people from the United States. And you have the Methodists, you have the Baptists, and of course, among the white Afrikaners, you have the Dutch Reformed Church.
And some Pentecostals starting.
Some small Pentecostal groups, yes. Now, in the Council of Churches of Namibia, the leading groups there, of course, are the Lutheran, Catholic, and Anglican. And by the way, that may be a little different from what you usually find in the United States. The Catholic Church is very active in the Council of Churches. Mostly here in the U.S., very often at least, I find that sometimes Catholics are not into the Council of Churches, but there they are. And I want to say a good word about the Council of Churches in Namibia and about all these Christian groups that I have mentioned that are in the Council, that they stand up for their people and have great, and the churches therefore have great credibility in Namibia. When somebody gets arrested or detained, they have great support openly from their pastoral leaders, from their bishops. Bishop Dumeni of the church in the north, Bishop Frederick of the church in the south. The people who get arrested, by the way, are very often leaders in the church, because the South African government knows that these are the people who are most actively opposed to the apartheid system, and that their members are following them and are depending on them for leadership in this struggle against their oppression. So these are things that I find to be very heartening, and that the churches are working so well together. The present executive secretary of the Council of Churches is Dr. Shevali, who is a Lutheran pastor. And the president of the Council of Churches is Bishop James Kauluma of the Anglican Church. So you see, they're doing things together nicely, and good cooperation, good spirit between those churches. I'm happy to say that. Yes, please.
Do you foresee from your experience any ending to apartheid?
Oh, yes. I think it's... I don't think it can be any other way. It will have to end. But as to when, that's what I can't... I just don't know how... I wouldn't know how to predict that. I would hope I could see it in my lifetime, but I am not sure that that is the case. And furthermore, I do believe that the situation will get worse before it gets better. There will be... There has been bloodshed regularly, and there's going to be more. There's going to be more.
Just before I left, South Africa put in a new government, almost all black, but
puppet
they,
government.
White government with black faces. They pretty much do, they still do what South Africa says. And the people you know, they didn't fool anybody there. The people knew what was happening, and they knew it. They, you know, they just had no respect for that government at all, and they came out and protested against it because they just don't accept it. You know, they're supposed to be a big step forward, but they realize it's not, because they can't make any, that government can't say anything except what South Africa tells them to say.
Well, two of you both are practically hand picks the members of that government. And most of them, as you say, people think of them as collaborators, that's all, public government.
So you're saying there's a separate black government?
No, it's the government that...
It's the government that South Africa has imposed on Namibia.
Okay.
And they've appointed the people, and they appoint black people who will be... will follow their orders, you see.
They just want to give, they just think they, you know, that they want to give the Namibians the idea that they have their own government, but it's just not true.
Namibians never vote. They don't vote for anything. No voting is happening. Particularly black people, I don't think they ever have. I don't know.
White people don't either.
They're not even whites. There's a lot of the white folk in Namibia would also like to see it independent for that reason. Particularly, well, more the Germans. There are a lot of Afrikaners who have come in. There's people from South Africa who have moved into Namibia over the years and have large farms and so forth. They would simply like to see Namibia become another province of South Africa. There is that kind of a movement.
They have three sets of bureaucracy. They have the white tier, and then they have a colored tier, and they have a black tier. And this is supposed to help let people develop on their own level, you know. And so if you work for the white government, you pay taxes to the white government. That is, if you're black or white or colored, you still pay your taxes to the white government. If you're black or, I mean, if you're white and you work in the black tier or the colored tier, you still pay your taxes to the white government. But if you're black and you're working in the white tier, you don't pay it to yours. Pay it to the white tier. And so, and of course the black people are the lowest paid of anybody in the country. You can work for, I guess if you work on the farm and work 8 hours a day, you probably would get maybe a rand and a half, which is about 75 cents.
Plus you're supposed to get
your housing and food, which is very, very limited. And also out of this has to pay for all the schooling, and any improvement that they might want to make in their community has to come out of their tax base. And of course they have hardly any money. The black, just, there's hardly anything. And then they have to divide it among, the black tribe has to be divided among all the different tribes too. And so it's just nothing left. And the white people have so much money, they just don't know what to do with it. That they just think of all kinds of stupid things that they don't need at all and to improve, but they would never give any of it to improve conditions for the black or the color. They'll close the white schools down because there aren't any kids around anymore, and the black schools are just overcrowded, but they won't let them use those schools.
Is the Peace Corps in that country?
No.
The
Peace Corps is not allowed because it's not an independent country. For example, the Peace Corps can be found here in this country. This is Lesotho. It's an independent country, entirely surrounded, of course, but it's independent. The Peace Corps is there, but not in Namibia. And after Namibia gains its independence, it will be open for that and for various other kinds of assistance, too. Perhaps a few words about the seminary. You might like to hear that. The seminary numbered about 35 students. We had two classes there. It was a four-year course, but there's two classes because we would have an entering class every other year. These would be coming from the Northern Church and from the Southern Church, and the lecturers, there were six of us who were ordained pastors, who were lecturers, as they called them. two of these came from the north, two of them from the south, and two of them, one was myself from the U.S. and the other our colleague from Germany. So that was our mix seminary. And Lois was on the staff as a teacher of English.
As a second language.
As a second language. And my niece was there for 1 year as a Lutheran World Ministries volunteer. She was also teaching English, and she was working in our library trying to bring that up to grade. The course, as I said, was 4 years. Now, we can't think of seminary in Namibia in the same way as we think of a seminary here, because many of our, I would say, not more than half of our students had the equivalent of a high school education. And probably not even half, eh? And some of them maybe 10th grade. So seminary isn't exactly the same as the way it is here, as you can imagine. Yet we were a part of a consortium of seminaries in southern Africa, where which included I think all the Protestant seminaries of southern Africa. The others were in South Africa. Ours was the only one in Namibia. There were three Lutheran seminaries. There's two of them in South Africa, and Moravian and Anglican and I think Presbyterian, Congregationalist. And anyway, we were part of this consortium. We used a common curriculum that each one of us was supposed to follow and at least teach this much, and the final exams were the same in every seminary for all the students, same final exams.
Same day. And
it had to be done on the same day, you know, in case somebody wanted to cheat, call on the phone and tell their buddy question number three or whatever it is. And they had this system of internal and external examiners, which means on the exams, the internal examiner would be like myself. I correct the final exams, but then I give them a mark. Then I send them all to an external examiner who's some professor or somebody down in South Africa, and he marks them. And his marks may or may not coincide with mine, but his are the ones that will count, and he's just kind of looking at mine for maybe a guideline. Most of the time, we weren't that far apart, but there were a couple of times when there were just some. I thought that the other guy, with the external examiner, was grossly wrong. Obviously. But, you know, I thought, well, I do. I know these students, and I know what they're thinking and so forth. But anyway, that was the kind of a system under which we were working. We're running short of time here. I wanted to talk a little bit about
The seminary, the church paid for all expenses. The students didn't have to pay anything. They were allowed to bring their wives and their wife and children with them, and many of them did. And all the expenses for the wife and children would be paid also. They would all eat at the seminary, and they would be housed there. And the food at the seminary was substantial, maybe not as good as we get here at home, but
no.
But they had meat maybe
suitable
two or three times a week, and then they had cornmeal, had it at least once a day. And that usually like looks sort of like cream of wheat. They would most at least once every day, and I think three times a week they would have it in the evening also. So that was their main stay. And bread.
Why is there a main pastor down there? Is that considered one type of position in the community and other things? It's pretty high. How about economics?
Well, economically, the pastors were, of course, they were paid probably a lot better than some of the poor guys working on the farms and stuff, even in the mines. But I wonder myself how they were able to survive. The average The average pay for a pastor was about 300, maybe 300 rands.
That was pretty high.
That would be kind of high. And that would be, in buying power, about equivalent to $300 here. By the exchange, it's less. By the exchange rate at that time was about $150. But in buying power, he could buy about $300 worth of goods. The thing that would help him would usually that a house was provided for him. He didn't have to pay, he didn't have the expense of rent or buying a house. It would be provided by the church. So they, it wasn't easy, but the position of being a pastor was, it was, is a high status position. That is correct. You are right in referring to that.
Because cost of living was really, I think, quite high there.
It's pretty similar to here, I think.
Yeah, but I don't know. Well, maybe. I just think about, you know, shopping for clothing and stuff like that. And I would just think, you know, how can they possibly afford to buy any of this? Especially, well.
Well, they had a bunch of stores throughout Namibia and South Africa. It was a franchise, I guess, or something. Pep, which is like Kmart, you know. And you could get all the cheap stuff there, cheaper clothing there, and that's where most of the black people had to do their shopping in there. We did too.
Sometimes. I think we spent for food. We probably spent, there were just two of us, but I guess we spent at least 150 rand a month. At least for just two. So I don't, you know, a lot of us had pretty big families. But still, I guess they were better off than those that worked on the farms.
Oh, yeah. Or the 35% who were unemployed.
But even think that are there a lot of charity or donation type things? You know, I think about that, like, you know, it's not a closet, you know, like the richer white people there, would they give things to places?
I don't know.
I never heard much of that.
I
not know. In an organized way. I never heard of such things.
We would get clothing from Europe, Germany, send clothing in. And then some people from the U.S. that would know that we needed things like that would send. But it's expensive to send, too, because the postage is so high.
Now, mostly, in other words, the help is coming from overseas.
Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe they did.
Well,
I assume they gave some of their clothes to the people who worked for them.
Yeah, they have a maid or a gardener, and they would get things like that. I think that's the way in which they did their charities, as nearly as I can see. There were some brave souls, you know, like, for example, Bishop Colin Winter was a former Anglican bishop who was deported. Well, he used to go to Katutura, which was the black section of Windhoek, bringing food and clothing and so forth, and the secret police were always following him, and for doing stuff like that, that's the kind of stuff for which you get deported. The Methodist Church, for example, remember that in Windhoek? They were trying to do a soup kitchen program in Katutura for unemployed people there. So mostly you see what is happening, it's through churches.
But then
and that's why the churches,
the
I think,
police really keep an eye on
has
the
such
church.
Credibility.
It's the same as in South America.
Oh, in
Everybody
Central America,
can,
yeah. What John Fish tells about, it's very similar what he'll tell you.
The government.
I think that it's time for us to bring it to a close, and we thank you very much.